Good morning. It's a little past 6 o'clock this morning, this Saturday, September 11th, and you're listening to WPKN 89.5 FM Bridgeport, Connecticut, and we stream live at WPKN.org, so you can reach us terrestrially or via the Internet. The name of today's program is In Context, WPKN's live call-in public affairs program. We examine issues often missed by the corporate media, and we invite you listeners to join our conversation. My name is Ken McDermott-Rowe, and I'm here with Gus Candavera.
Good morning.
And Gus and I will be here with you for the next 3 hours till 9 o'clock in the morning. Today, of course, is the 9th anniversary of the terror attack of 9/11. And to commemorate this tragic event, Gus and I have developed a special program for this morning. It's titled From JFK to 9/11. During the program, we're going to present for your consideration and comment material related to the assassinations of President John F. Kennedy, Reverend Martin Luther King, and Senator Robert Kennedy. The information we'll present on these murders, it might be new to you, but I'm sure you'll find it interesting. We're also going to examine important aspects of the 9/11 attacks as they've been illuminated by independent researchers in the last several years. For example, we'll consider the theory that the World Trade Center was brought down in a controlled demolition with pre-planted explosives, as well as questions as to what actually hit the Pentagon on 9/11. Later on the program, we'll, as usual, open the lines for phone calls, and we want very much to hear what you think about the subjects we're discussing. And we'll be giving out that phone number in a little bit. And since this is WPKN's fundraising drive, we've also developed a valuable premium for From JFK to 9/11 that I'm sure you'll want to have. For a pledge of $100 to WPKN, you can receive the following as part of the premium. The book, The New Pearl Harbor, by Professor David Ray Griffin. Now, this book, The New Pearl Harbor, was the work that really started off a whole series of independent investigations into what really happened on 9/11. It's been carried on by many other researchers. Today, there's now an organization called Architects and Engineers for 9/11 Truth with over 1,000 members that are looking into what really caused the collapse of the World Trade Center. So that book, The New Pearl Harbor, by David Ray Griffin, is part of the premium. We also have assembled a 3D set of 5 History Counts programs. History Counts is a series that I did for the last 3 years on subjects that have been largely ignored by the mainstream media. And this set, entitled From JFK to 9/11, includes 5 History Counts programs, including the CIA and the assassination of President Kennedy, which was with Joan Mellon, a one-on-one conversation, who wrote A Farewell to Justice and followed up the Jim Garrison investigation. The next interview is The Execution of Martin Luther King, which I did with William Pepper, who was attorney for the King family. And he represented the King family in a 1999 civil case in which a Tennessee jury found that Martin Luther King was not shot by James Earl Ray. So that has some very interesting information in it. And third show, a History Counts show, is Who Killed Bobby Kennedy, with the author and filmmaker Sean O'Sullivan, who talked to me about the evidence that Senator Robert Kennedy was not killed by Sirhan Sirhan. In fact, he was killed, he was almost certainly killed by another as yet unknown gunman who was standing behind him. And then finally, we have 2 programs that we did in History Counts with the 2 leading experts on the 9/11 disaster. The first is physics professor Stephen Jones, who joined me for a show called Why Indeed Did the World Trade Center Collapse? And Professor Jones did the seminal work as a physicist on the collapse of the World Trade Center. And the second of these 9/11 shows, which we're offering in the premium, is 9/11 Unanswered Questions, with Professor David Ray Griffin. I spent an hour talking to Professor Griffin about 9/11, and of course, he is the author of The New Pearl Harbor. In addition to these this 3D set of 5 History Counts programs and the book, there is more. We have, in addition to that, 2 audio mixes prepared by our general manager and DJ extraordinaire, Peter Beauchan. One is called A Shortcut Back to Dallas, and the other is A Shortcut Back to 9/11. And in each of these audio mixes, Peter Beauchan combines contemporary newsreels, news accounts with music and interviews of witnesses. And it's very entertaining, and it also brings you right back to the period.
And we're going to be playing some of those cuts.
And we will be playing cuts from the clips. We will pay clips from those premiums today. And you can get the programs in their entirety, of course, by calling 203-384-9756. That's our pledge line, and making a $100 pledge to WPKN. So please make a note of that pledge number. It's 203-384-9756 for this really fantastic premium that we have for $100 from JFK to 9/11. And we do have our volunteer, Bonnie, back in the tally room right now at 6, a little after 6 o'clock in the morning. She journeyed in to man the phones, to take your calls, and she'll be happy to arrange for you to receive the from JFK to 9/11 premium. She's a very dedicated volunteer, and of course, that's what makes this station work. We are able to bring you not only music that you don't hear on other stations, but public affairs program that you don't hear on other stations. Now, today's the anniversary of 9/11, and you can turn the dial across the radio spectrum, and you can go on your cable TV and look at all the networks, and I guarantee you will not hear on any of those sources of information the information that we're going to hear in the next 3 hours in this program. In addition to covering the assassinations of the Kennedy brothers and Reverend King and questions about 9/11, we're also going to explore some related questions. Gus, could you give us a rundown on some of the other points that you'd like to raise today?
Yes. Good morning, everybody, and happy Patriot Day. During the research for this, I didn't even know this, but during looking up everything for the shows, the past two shows and today that we've been doing, I saw where there was an actual piece of legislation that designated 9/11 as Patriot Day.
That's right. It's what it says on my calendar.
Yeah,
Patriot Day.
I didn't even know that. But what's the reason for that? Is that to make everyone feel like it's being memorialized?
I think it was to conflate the terror attack with patriotism, so
yeah.
That it's really the oldest propaganda trick in the book when you want to go to war. I mean, what did Hermann Göring said that the people don't want to go to war.
Mm-hmm.
People never want to go to war. He said, but you can always drag them into a war. He said it's very simple. You just combine it with patriotism. Those who oppose the war are unpatriotic, and
right.
It's a done deal.
And that's exactly why we have things that are legislation that's named stuff like the Patriot Act.
It's really Kafkaesque, and we did cover this in a discussion I had a couple years ago with Professor Mark Crispin Miller on propaganda,
yeah.
On the use of terminology, which often has the opposite of its literal meaning. And if you keep repeating it, and these repetitions come from authorities, they get accepted by the populace.
And you use words like patriot and, you know, American and, you know, anytime they want to rouse some kind of emotion from people, they use the right keywords.
That's right. Absolutely. And that's,
and you're either with us or you're against us. And, you know, you don't want to be an enemy.
It's a
basic, look what happens to our enemy.
The basic tools of propaganda are a transference of an emotion. You create an emotion,
right.
And let's say it's the horror of the World Trade Center collapsing, and then you tie that emotion to a word like, say, Al-Qaeda. And you keep repeating World Trade Center, Al-Qaeda, and then you can transfer Al-Qaeda to just about anybody you want.
Right.
And how often do you read a news story where it says, so-and-so, such-and-such organization, believed to be a link to Al-Qaeda. So once that third person now is tied right back into 9/11, all that horror.
Right, automatically associating it with terror and those same feelings that people had on 9/11.
And Walter Lippmann talks about that technique in detail in his book Public Opinion, which is the seminal work I commend to listeners. That you can still get it at bookstores. Public Opinion, he wrote it back, I believe, in the 1920s. And Lippmann believed, and it really is a reigning ideology, that the intellectual of a society, that their purpose, that their function is to manufacture the consent of the people to what the leaders, the elite, have decided is going to happen.
Right.
Because I guess we're too dumb to figure it out. And I think Lippmann must have been conflicted about this, because he wasn't totally anti-democratic, but the whole concept of it is fundamentally anti-democratic, and it's what we're subjected
to
today.
It's manufacturing consent.
Manufacturing consent.
Getting people to go along, making it a popular opinion, something that previously would have been unpopular, or unpopular if they knew the real reason
why they wanted
it to be popular.
That's right. And so what we try to do at PKN here is, because we're non-commercial, we don't have any corporate advertising, we don't have any corporate underwriting, we're non-commercial, we're supported by you listeners, we can bring you information that you're not going to receive that from other sources. And that's why we really appreciate your support. Gus and I come in here. We're volunteers. All the programmers are volunteers. And we appreciate your support by calling 203-384-9756. I know it's early in the morning, but if you can get to the phone and call in, we will really appreciate your support keeping us on the air.
That's right. And remember, donating to one of the premiums for the public affairs is a vote for public affairs here at PKN. And if you want to hear more content like what we're bringing you today and what we brought in the past, then try to do your best and call in and give a little bit toward the cause. So some of the other topics we're going to be covering today, we're going to delve into something that's really, really important but little known to the American people especially, and that's the history of false flag. A false flag is an attack on your own side using false colors, and it's comes from flying someone else's flag, a false flag. And whenever you want to try to, like we said, manufacture consent, you try to blame something on an enemy, and that will get the populace to rally behind your nation symbol, their flag, to fight against the outsider. You know, because we are all tribal at heart. You know, we all try to protect ourselves against the outsider. And that just plays on that emotion. And we're going to be covering how that has been used in the past, the distant past and the near recent past, to cause war and to get legislation passed and have governments silently overthrown as a result.
And it's an old trick. And yet it works every time.
It works all the time. You know, in our last show, we talked about how history is new all the time because we had a caller called in and said, history repeats itself because no one was listening the first time. And, and I joked about that in response and just saying it's all new to me because I don't know what happened before. And that's true. It really is true. You know, it's kind of like having a short-term memory loss. And, you know, kids will do this where they don't believe things that have happened before because they just don't have enough life experience to understand that, well, it's going to repeat itself because it's the same exact situation. So it's like reaching up and touching a hot plate just to make sure it's hot or see if it's hot.
I think that's an important element, but another element.
Like a 5 or 6-year-old will do that. They'll reach up and touch a hot plate and like, they'll burn their hand. They're like, holy crap, I burned my hand. But then like 3 days later, they'll do it again just to see what happens.
It's empirical and it's curiosity. But we're not learning about these events from the mainstream media. They may be very relevant. But we're just not hearing about them.
And,
we're,
I mean,
we're not
school,
getting educated.
I feel school is completely useless. I really do. I mean, I was homeschooled. I didn't go to school. And I know I went to college. I graduated from college. And I kind of feel like the way that people are taught to learn, they're taught to learn. They don't learn the way that they naturally would learn. And that's by observation. They're instructed.
That's right.
And people aren't instructed to trust their eyes. They're instructed to trust what their instructors tell them.
That's right.
So they could see something on the news that is contrary to what their eyes and their brain tells them is normal or natural. But because the announcer on television, because Walter Cronkite says, this is what's happening, you believe it.
That's right. There's a huge difference between our senses, and perception, and I think it's fascinating. It plays into propaganda. We're exposed to all the stimuli, but it doesn't necessarily penetrate. Mm-hmm. And whether it penetrates depends, perhaps, on the narrative we created in our mind. Say my government is good. So when I hear information that says my government's torturing people, yeah. I don't accept that. That fact's not imprinted on my mind.
Well, if they're torturing people, it must be for a good reason.
It must somehow we have to rationalize.
They probably deserved it
because my belief system, my narrative says my government is good. But in a democracy, it's absolutely essential that we look at the truth, that we look at facts, because we are the governors of this country. We're the ones who run this country under our Constitution. And for us to run this country, we must know the facts. You can't have – our government is based upon the consent of the governed, and you can't have an informed consent if we don't know what's going on.
Right.
So that's what we're going to do today. And maybe we'll – can we start off perhaps to set the mood this morning with Peter Beauchamp's piece, the one he did on 9/11?
Absolutely. Yeah. Let me –
Gus is going to cue that up for you. And let me just give out our pledge line again. It's 203-384-9756. 973-3849756. You're listening to WPKN 89.5 FM in Bridgeport, Connecticut. We're streaming live at WPKN.org. And I know this is a third in a series of shows we've done the last 2 weeks or 10 days
right.
on 9/11. And I know we have gotten calls from people who are listening to us on the stream or outside the broadcast area. So later when we open the phones, I hope you'll call in, whether you're hearing us on our signal and you're living in the Connecticut or New York area, or wherever you're listening, if you're listening on the stream.
Some to the rivers and some to the sea.
We observe today not a victory of party, but a celebration of freedom, symbolizing an end as well as a beginning, signifying renewal as well as change. Let the word go forth from this time and place to friend and foe alike, that the torch has been passed to a new generation of Americans born in this century. And so, my fellow Americans, ask not what your country can do for you. Ask what you can do for your country.
It's 83 degrees in Dallas at 11 o'clock. From the world, the nation, and the Texas News Triangle, this is KLIF Hourly News. United Nations Secretary General Thant says there is no justification for arresting Katanga President Chombe in Elizabethville. Successful stationary test of Titan II intercontinental ballistic missile has been made at Vandenberg Air Force Base. The largest student demonstration to date against Negro James Meredith has been broken up by University of Mississippi campus police.
At the tone, standard time will be 12, 7, and 30 seconds.
Well, I remember how being terribly shocked and incredible the whole thing that this sort of thing could happen in the United States.
Just a few minutes ago, the President of the United States turned from the
Gentleman of Western Control Central
on Street on his way to a scheduled luncheon appearance at the
Stemmons
Trade Park. As the President turned, applause broke out from a sparse crowd on both sides of the street.
I apologize. The status you hear on the radio.
Headed for the Triple Underpass, there were three loud, reverberating explosions. Nobody moved. Everyone seemed stunned. A few seemed to look around, wondering who has the firecrackers. Then suddenly the Secret Service men sprang into action. The convertible bearing the President and Mrs. Kennedy sped away, and officers, both plainclothes and uniformed, seemed to spring from everywhere at once, guns drawn, ordering people to lie flat. There are two witnesses who were near the President's car at the time of the explosions who say that shots were fired. From which upper window, we do not know. We do not and cannot confirm the reports at this time that the President has been shot.
And I walked into the common room, and the TV set was blank, but on, there were a whole bunch of people standing around. And coming out of the TV set was just a sound, the guy saying, and then Jackie said, "Oh no, Jack, oh no."
At the tone, standard time will be 12:58 and 50 seconds.
I was in the army when that happened. Maybe a day or so later, then I realized it was President Kennedy who was killed. You know what I mean? Then it dawned on me who the dude was, you know, when they started comparing him with his Abe Lincoln, who was shot in almost the same manner, right?
And they rang the bells early, and we all went back to our homeroom, and the principal got on the public address system. He made an announcement. And our principal had a great flair. He was a great showman. He liked to make long speeches. He was very flowery on the public address system. And we all thought it was going to be another speech, don't talk in the halls, we're going to dismiss you early, so the teachers are going to have a conference. But this isn't really an early dismissal. This will be something very special. So he got on the public address system, and he said, "Ladies and gentlemen, the President of the United States, John F. Kennedy, is dead."
At the tone, standard time will be 1 o'clock. Exactly.
It was like the light was out in the middle of the day. And no, it was too much.
It was raining terribly. It was almost black. It never became day, the whole day. I remember that more than anything else. I was in my house, and I had the television on. And I remember that it was a day that was not a day. It was always night.
We were going home in the bus, and we were all screaming. Then I got home. My mother was out in front. She was crying. Everybody was crying.
I don't want historians 10 years from now to say these were the years when the tide ran out for the United States. I want them to say these were the years when the tide came in. These were the years when the United States started to move again. That's the question before the American people, and only you can decide what you want this country to be, what you want to do with the future. I think we're ready to move.
Okay, so that was
That was back to Dallas. That was Peter Beauchamp's mix. And we started off with Kennedy because in our program today, from JFK to 9/11, because the execution or the assassination of President Kennedy on November 22nd, 1963 was a real turning point in modern American history. And now I'm speaking today, I think everybody should be aware, as Ken McDermott Rowe and Gus and I are going to give our frank opinions, we're not giving the opinion of WPKN, and that's true of our guests and our callers, of course, is that the government, the ability to remove a president of the United States, and I think that's what happened, it was essentially a coup d'etat, said that whoever is in charge of this country, it's not the people of the United States. Whether you were a great admirer of President Kennedy or not, whoever the president is, he's elected by us. He is the people's representative. And we vote him in and we vote him out. And nobody should have the right to take our president away from us. And that's what happened on November 22nd, 1963. And the program that we have with Joan Mellon, which is part of the premium from JFK to 9/11, Joan Mellon traces the CIA connections to the assassination of President Kennedy. And we now know a lot more information that we knew than was known in the 1960s when Jim Garrison began his investigation. And many of you may have seen that movie, JFK, by Oliver Stone. And basically, it does a good job of telling the story of Jim Garrison's prosecution. Jim Garrison was aware of all the problems with, logistical problems with, the accusation that Lee Harvey Oswald killed President Kennedy. He knew Oswald didn't do it, and in fact, Oswald was, as he claimed, a patsy. But Garrison was not focusing on the mechanics of the assassination of President Kennedy. He wanted to know who was in charge of it, and he came to understand that the assassination of President Kennedy was planned in New Orleans, Louisiana, where he was the district attorney, and it was planned by U.S. intelligence agencies. And Lee Harvey Oswald was actually a low-level a functionary of the national security establishment, and he was brought to New Orleans, and as Joan Mellon says, sheep-dipped by the CIA to become a Marxist, a pro-Castro, a person who infiltrated Fair Play for Cuba, and he was set up to be a agent of the Cuban regime, of the Castro regime, in the assassination of President Kennedy. And that's what it was, that's what Clay Shaw was all about. And we now know that Clay Shaw, who always protested that he didn't know anything, that he had no involvement in it, that he in fact was a significant CIA agent, that he was the head of a CIA front, an international trade group in New Orleans, that he had the authority to recruit agents. So he was an important person. He had been in the OSS. He was Army intelligence. And many of the people who worked with him also had, like Guy Bannister, also had important intelligence connections. So when they saw the fingerprints of CIA all over this assassination.
The CIA has their fingerprints all over everything. They're one of the most busy organizations in the world. Ron Paul has called for the deactivation of the CIA. And, you know, I've discussed that with regular people, you know, just people on the street, just asking them what their opinion are. you know, friends of mine or just strangers, and you get into the topic on the CIA or the arm or the war or anything like that. And I'll say, yeah, I think the CIA should be dismantled, you know. And they would say, no, 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 absolutely not. That's crazy. The reason why we get into this problem that we have now, the reason 9/11 happened is because, you know, the Democrat presidents pulled our ears off the ground and our, you know, our feet off the ground and ears around the world. And say, how is it? What are you talking about? You have no idea. Like, that's, it's like what we're talking about before the clip. You were saying, like, people are not trained to trust their ears and their minds and their eyes.
And that's so important. We are citizens in democracy. We're supposed to be making the decisions. And the fact you cite Ron Paul, I think, is very instructive, because this desire to regain popular control of our government from the CIA and the national security apparatus is not a left-right issue.
Right.
Because Ron Paul's a libertarian. People would call him a conservative or on the political right, whatever that means. But I think Dennis Kucinich, who is a Democrat and is on the liberal, progressive or liberal side,
yeah,
feels the same way, whether it's about the CIA or even the related issue of the banking system and the idea that our country's really, our economy is controlled by a private banking cartel. These are issues that...
And they realized how deep the tentacles go from the CIA. They know, because they've been around Kucinich and Paul. They're in their 60s. They're older guys. Actually, no, Paul's in his now 70s, but they're older guys, and they know the far reach of the CIA station agents around the world and how every country that they operate in, there are shenanigans that go on a daily basis. And whenever any kind of regime gets any kind of different idea from the American Western perspective, there's trouble.
That's
there always
right.
is. And it, what it does is it creates opposition. It creates terrorists. It creates the reasons why we have opposition in the world. You know, when we go and we overthrow a government, it's not because we just have a difference of opinion and, you know, they are a democratically elected republic with a constitution and they just think, well, you know, we just want to trade with a different country or trade our coffee beans or whoever for a different rate of return. No, it's because we want them to do it for free or the lowest possible denomination. And, you know, we're going to go in and we're just going to assault you until you do it, like a bunch of gangsters.
Exactly. It's really a gangster.
It's a shakedown.
It's a gangster type operation. And that's not the kind of country we want. And that's not the kind of people Americans are. I think we're a people who believe in fair play. I think America is about in personal liberty. It's about making a good living for yourself and your family, working hard. And it's not
pursuit
about
of happiness.
It's not about exploiting other people. So I think fundamentally this clique that's gotten control of our foreign policy doesn't share the values of the average American. And somehow we've got to get back in control.
And I mean, it's like any movie, what is it, The Good Shepherd?
The Good Shepherd about the CIA?
Yeah.
The one with Matt Damon?
That's right. That's
excellent
what a
movie.
Great movie that is. And I mean, there's that scene where you know, the CIA is brand new and it's at the end of the movie and they're standing in the hallway. I think they're right over that CIA seal on the floor. And I guess the director of the CIA is talking to the other character and he says, you know, can you believe that the Senate actually wants to have some kind of civilian oversight to the Central Intelligence Agency? And then he laughs and he says, like they could ever keep their eyes on us.
That's right. That's right. If you just joined us, you're listening to WPKN 89.5 FM in Bridgeport, Connecticut, and streaming live at WPKN.org. And this is the WPKN Pledge Drive. And if you can call in and support the kind of programming you're listening to now, the name of this program is From JFK to 9/11, and our series is called In Context. Please give us a call. For $100, you can receive an excellent premium by calling 203-384-9756. That's 203-384-9756. And for a $100 premium a pledge, you get an incredible premium value, The New Pearl Harbor by David Ray Griffin, which was the book that started off all of this reexamination of 9/11. 6 years ago it came out, and it's just spawned thousands and thousands of researchers who've done great work, which you can see, you can listen to on WPKN, but you will not hear, unfortunately, in the other media. But it's out there, and it's great information. We also have a 3D set of 5 History Counts programs entitled From JFK to 9/11, programs on the assassination of President Kennedy, Martin Luther King, Bobby Kennedy, and 2 programs on 9/11, including an hour-long interview with Professor David Ray Griffin, which I did myself. In addition to that, we have 2 audio mixes on Back to Dallas, 1963, and Back to 9/11 by our general manager, Peter Beauchamp.
I want to play one of the other clips from the premium from the Joan Mellon interview, because she talks about the sheep dipping.
Yes.
And I want to segue that back into 9/11 and weave a tapestry here.
Okay, great.
One of the things that I discovered in my research was that Oswald not only worked for the CIA, which was he was part of the false defector program going into the Soviet Union, organized by CIA counterintelligence chief James Angleton. Not only did he work for the FBI, but Oswald also worked for U.S. Customs. And the depositions of the U.S. Customs officers, they would depose before the Church Committee in the mid-1970s, and those depositions are still closed to this day. And the reason we have the information is that the summaries of the depositions somehow managed to become public. So we see in the summaries that Oswald worked for Customs, too. And this is not surprising, because very often in those years, the CIA and Customs exchanged agents.
Oswald is in Russia as a defector. Apparently, he makes a dramatic announcement to the U.S. Embassy in Moscow in 1959 that his allegiance is now to Russia, not to the United States. Here's a former Marine. It must have received some publicity. And then about a year later, he comes back. How did that happen?
Well, Oswald came back to the United States courtesy of the State Department, which paid his way and made him a loan, which is sort of unheard of for a defector. You know, he was not a defector. And in fact, people have often asked, well, how come he wasn't debriefed if he was a CIA plant? And in fact, we have new evidence, new documents that have come out in the year 2006, which reveal that Oswald was, in fact, debriefed. There's no question that he was part of that false defector program.
So Oswald comes back to the United States. He's supposedly a traitor, but the State Department brings him back. And his first job is with a Riley Coffee Company in New Orleans. What kind of place is that?
One of the things that really benefited me and many others enormously was the passage of the JFK Act in 1992, which was a result of letters written to Congress by people who had seen Oliver Stone's film JFK and said, if Oliver Stone is wrong, open the files. So open go the files, and we find all kinds of information, such as the fact that the head of the Riley Coffee Company has two different kinds of CIA clearances. And what Garrison concluded after looking at all of this, there was no one with whom Oswald was associated who was not with the CIA.
There's an expression that's used in the book, sheep dipping, for what was happening to Oswald while he was in New Orleans. What is sheep dipping?
Sheep dipping means giving you another identity. And in other words, Oswald was sheep dipped as pro-Castro. There he is on the streets of New Orleans giving out leaflets that say fair play for Cuba, pro-Castro. And I think what we see there is that the original plan of the CIA was to blame Castro for the assassination of President Kennedy. At some point, they changed their minds and they decided it's too complicated, because here was Castro, after all, involved with President Kennedy's emissaries in seeking rapprochement, seeking to make friends with the United States. Kennedy had sent down his friend William Atwood, and they were involved in those negotiations. It would be impossible to prove that Castro really was behind the assassination. Before that, the idea was that Oswald would be shown to be someone who was working for Castro and trying to help him, and therefore giving out these leaflets, and on behalf of Castro, killed President Kennedy as retaliation for all the efforts of the CIA to attempt to kill Castro.
So he was reinvented and then returned to Dallas.
He was. And so who was he? When Oswald is arrested in Dallas, he asks even for a Communist Party lawyer named John Abt. What he's doing is signaling to his CIA handlers and bosses, and he's saying, listen, I'm still with the program. You told me to pretend to be a communist, and that's what I'm trying to do.
Now, of course, Oswald's shot by Jack Ruby, and I was surprised that Jack Ruby was not just a mobster who, for some unknown reason, shot Oswald, but he also was involved with anti-Castro Cubans, was he not?
Well, yes, he was. The CIA's own Inspector General's report of 1967 reveals is that the CIA enlisted mafia people in their attempts to kill Castro. We know that. Johnny Roselli, Sam Giancana, Santo Traficante. So it's not surprising that Jack Ruby, with his mob connections, would also be tapped as a person that the CIA could use in the murder of Lee Harvey Oswald. One of the things I discovered in my book, and there were other examples, many examples of the fact that Ruby knew Oswald well.
So Ruby knew Oswald well. These guys were all interconnected, and it's an amazing story. Joan Mellon took the Jim Garrison investigation from 1966-67, and then she updated it with material that was released during the Clinton administration and put it together in her book, A Farewell to Justice. And what I did in that interview was I went carefully through her book and tried to extract all of the key elements that she revealed about the CIA's connection with the JFK assassination and put it together in that one-on-one half-an-hour interview, which was really what the History Counts program method was. So that program, Farewell to Justice with Joan Mellon, is part of our premium. It's one of five History Counts programs that's included in the premium, as well as the book, The New Pearl Harbor by David Ray Griffin, who started the whole independent investigation movement for 9/11, plus the Peter Beauchamp audio mixes. And you can get those that premium for $100, $100 pledge to WPKN by calling 203-384-9756. So please give a call. Our phone volunteer Bonnie is waiting back there in the tally room. She came in at 6 o'clock this morning to answer your calls. It's 203-384-9756.
So I wanted to get back into expanding on the CIA angle. You know, they've been involved with every single thing that's happened in the past 60, 70 years in this country since their inception. What was it, 1943?
It was just at the end of World War II. And actually, it's a good example of how the national security state is tied in with the business leadership. Mm-hmm. The man who asked for the CIA to be established was his new Secretary of Defense through his new department. Was named Forrestal, and he had been president of the Dillon Bank. So he came from Wall Street. And the CIA charter was hammered out, not in in a congressional committee, but in the boardrooms of Wall Street Wall Street banks and law firms by Alan Dulles and Wall Street lawyers. And they did this. They did this, you know, representing obviously the interest, the corporate interest that they represented in their livelihood. Dulles and his brother, who became Secretary of State, were partners at the famous corporate law firm in New York of Sullivan and Cromwell. So they did this thing. It's unbelievable to me. Peter Dale Scott tells the story in the Road to 9/11 that the origins of the CIA was on Wall Street, literally, not just figuratively.
Isn't it an insult that there's an airport named after Dulles? The Washington, D.C. airport is named Dulles International Airport, right?
That's right. It's very personal. For example,
not Washington Airport or, right, you know, Thomas Jefferson Airport.
We did get a Reagan airport. At least it's named after a popular president. That was good.
Do we have any airports named after founding fathers? Is there like a Benjamin Franklin International Airport?
No, there's the leader. That's the kind of leader that we need today, Ben Franklin.
Those aren't the people that we really memorialize, though.
No.
We have like little, you know, icons of them or something like that, like the spectacles or the kite with the key or something like that. But, you know, Thomas Jefferson's like hair, but like there's nothing, there's nothing about them that people learn to respect anymore.
That's right. I think we really need to rediscover our heroes. And we do have some great heroes. The one we covered in the series History Counts and nobody knows about is Smedley Butler, who was a Marine Corps general. And he fought in every – won two Congressional Medals of Honor, served in every rank from second lieutenant up to two-star general. He was in line to become head of the Marine Corps. He was in every war between the Spanish-American War right through the 1920s, all of America's wars. And near the end of his military career, the light bulb went on. And he wrote a book called War is a Racket.
War is a Racket.
War is a Racket. He said, I came to understand that the soldiers, including myself, were just errand boys for Standard Oil being sent around the world to protect their corporate interests. And Smedley Butler became the greatest anti-war spokesman in America throughout the 1930s. He was a tremendous hero and very well known. And now no one knows his name, but he was a real hero.
You know, he's someone who's regaining popularity. I see his name around a lot, and I see a lot of references to his books.
Is that right?
Yeah, and Fletcher Prouty as well. I mean, Jesse Ventura recently was touting Fletcher Prouty's books.
Is that right? And Fletcher Prouty,
Deep State,
listeners, was a colonel in the U.S. Air Force who was the Pentagon's liaison with the CIA in covert operations from about 1955, I think, to 1963. And Prouty admitted, after he retired, Prouty started writing books about what he did. I guess he had second thoughts about it. And he would go on TV. I saw him on C-SPAN. He lived for quite a many years after he retired. And he exposed the murder operations that he was involved in. And he said, I used to sit in a room with Alan Dulles. This would be in probably the late 50s.
There he is again.
And the phone would ring. And Prouty said, Dulles would talk for a little while. He put down the phone. And then he'd say, so-and-so has to go. Which obviously meant he had to be killed. And Prouty said, I never knew who was at the other end of those phone calls.
Yeah.
So I decided to call them the secret team.
Mm-hmm.
He said, so then I got my orders to kill so-and-so. And he said, I will put together the operation. And he said, we would have two groups working on an assassination. He said, you'd have the mechanics who are going to shoot the guy or poison him or blow up his airplane, whatever. They'd work on one side of the hallway. And he said, on the other side of the hallway, you had a much bigger group. And these guys were planning the cover stories. And that you would make cover stories so complex that it was like the layers of an onion. And you'd get through one layer, and there'd be another, and another, and you never get to the truth. And he was still in this job in 1963 when Kennedy was assassinated, but obviously he wasn't part of it because I was sent on a goodwill mission to guess where Antarctica.
Mm-hmm.
So Prouty's flown to Antarctica.
Bring gifts to the penguins.
Yeah. And he says, I was flying back to the United States and I was in New Zealand and I was with a friend and I opened the newspaper and I said, oh my God, there has been a coup d'etat in the United States. He said, I looked at this article and here was a picture of this guy Oswald with his gun and all this information about him. And he said, that's how I do it. That's how it's done. You have the story, you have the patsy, and it's all ready to go. You do the hit, and everything's out, and you've got an explanation for what happened.
When you've done something so many times, or so when you know your job or your business, you can identify when something.
He said right away.
Sounds
like
it.
That's my kind of work. He said,
yeah,
that's, you know, that was a coup d'état. You know, and then, but it was very successfully covered up, at least in the short time term, and the Warren Commission went along with the cover up, and of course, who ran the Warren Commission? But Alan Dulles. He was the man who ran the Warren.
That's the logical solution.
And then, you look at the cast of characters involved in the Warren Commission. There was Jerry Ford was on the Warren Commission, who we now know was a liaison between the Warren Commission, between Dulles and J. Edgar Hoover, so that they could harmonize.
Yeah.
Their investigation.
Just like the 9/11 Commission was full of this is interesting. The 9/11 Commission was full of insiders. Every single person on the 9/11 Commission was a former politician of some sort.
People who are compliant to
a representative some industry or another that was all essentially complicit or involved in 9/11.
And the
But the commission itself still acknowledged that it was a scam. They said the commission was set up to fail. It was a scam. They were thinking about suing the government for breach of, what was it? Blocking
obstruction of justice. That's right. Kane and Hamilton, who headed the commission, who were not, you know, any brave guys.
No, not at all.
If they want to cover up, they ask Lee Hamilton to head the committee. Even he said that it was set up to fail, and he was considering obstruction of justice prosecution against the justice,
that could
against
just
the FBI
be
and the
yet
FAA.
Another cover story. You know,
it could be. They never came clean, but the Max Cleland, who was the wounded veteran, Vietnam vet, he resigned from the commission. He said it was a complete farce, and he wouldn't serve on it because he realized that the government was coming up with the information. And of course, Philip Zelikow ran the commission. In these deals, that seems
Zelikow's the real insider,
the staff
there.
Director,
the controller.
He runs these things. And Philip Zelikow is a national security aide in the Bush administration. He was a close confidant of Condoleezza Rice. And the year after the 9/11 commission, the year after 9/11, he was an architect of one of the planning documents for military expansion. So the 9/11 commission seems to be part of his assignment to bring about this big expansion of the U.S. military, which, as we know, was talked about in great detail by the Project for the New American Century.
Among others. And the New American Century was headed up by Dick Cheney.
So you see, it does come down to individuals. People say, well, you know, who is this corporate cabal? Well, you usually, you know, at any given time in history, you can put names and faces together with these things. And the new Project for the New American Century produced that document, Rebuilding American Defenses, where they called for a massive expansion of the U.S. military.
And the reason why they call for that? Why? Because they're all CEOs on defense contractors.
That's right.
They all make the missile defense shields. They make the...
That's right.
The
It was funded by military, the people who make the Bradley fighting vehicle funded the project for the new American century. And they called also in that document, and you can see it online, folks. It was produced about the time that Bush Jr. came into office. It said, how will we get the American people behind this massive expansion of our global expansion of our military? It said it will require something like a new Pearl Harbor.
And that's where the name of that book comes from by David Ray Griffin.
Precisely.
And the reason he called it that was because, well, beside the similarities of 3,000 people dying in both catastrophes, there was foreknowledge of both events. 9/11 and Pearl Harbor were both known about by the government before it happened, and both were allowed to happen.
Yes.
Both were pretexts for war. Both rallied people around the American flag.
That's right.
Both allowed draconian legislation to be passed. Pearl Harbor got Japanese Americans rounded up into prison camps and forced to labor for free.
That's right.
They were all denied their First Amendment, their Second Amendment, their whole Bill of Rights was violated. They were falsely imprisoned indefinitely.
That's right. And there's the analogy today with the Patriot Act and with the excesses of the FBI.
Yeah, quote-unquote Patriot Act.
That's right.
Again, it feels so patriotic to have your rights violated.
I was looking at some of the institutions that that have been created, and one is the FBI's National Investigative Letter, which was Section 505 of the Patriot Act, which allows the FBI, they don't have to go to court. They don't have to show probable cause.
That's for chumps.
They can just send out a letter and asking you to produce your records and other data. And this is violates our protection against illegal searches and seizures.
Exactly.
But is it rare? No. I saw that between 2003 and 2006, they issued almost 200,000 these outrageous letters where they ask for documents without a search warrant, without a court order.
That's also like putting Americans for absolutely no reason onto the terror watch list or the no-fly list. And the no-fly list is also connected to, I don't know if it already is, but yeah, the ability to buy a gun, the gun registry.
Is that right?
And so they're infringing on your Second Amendment right as well, because if you're on the terror watch list, you can't buy a gun. And if you're on the terror watch list, you can't get off the terror watch list. If you're on the terror watch list, you can't even ask why you're on the terror watch list. You can't fly, you can't do anything unless you get a body cavity search. I mean, this is for 5-year-olds as well. There's a YouTube clip of like a 5-year-old at the airport, and his mother is trying to console him because he has the same name as another terrorist. So he's on the terror watch list, and they shake him down. They take his toys away.
Right.
And then the mother goes to give the little boy a hug, and they say, ma'am, don't touch him. Now we have to research him because you could have given him something. All right? And this is a 5-year-old. They just have absolutely no common sense.
Well, war, I think a lot of what's going on at the airports is theater. I think it's to keep
up
the scare.
Complete theater.
It's, if you see something, say something. It's to keep us in a constant state of fear so that we knuckle under to this the infringements in our civil rights, to this endless war. And that's kind of the beauty of the war, the perverse beauty of the war that was spawned by 9/11, is that it's a war of indefinite duration, of complete global reach. Anyone, civilian, it doesn't matter, can be the enemy. The enemy is whoever the government says the enemy is. It's really right out in 1984 with Bin Laden.
Totally like 1984. Go ahead.
Like being Emmanuel Goldstein
exactly.
as Bin Laden.
Exactly. My son's reading 1984 now, and he gets through the first page, and he comes to me, and he says, who's Emmanuel Goldstein? I can't tell you that. That ruins the entire book.
Did you want to talk about some of the analogies
dipping? It's just like my mind just – it's like setting off firecrackers in my head as soon as we talk about one of these things. It reminds me about something else and I just can't ever stay on track.
If you just joined us, you're listening to WPKN 89.5 FM streaming live at WPKN.org. We're in our fundraiser mode and we're offering a premium along with the show. The show is called From JFK to 9/11. And the premium includes 5 History Counts programs on assassinations, as well as 9/11, with the leading experts on 9/11, Professor David Ray Griffin and Professor Stephen Jones. It also includes audio mixes by Peter Beauchamp, and it includes the book that started it all, The New Pearl Harbor, by our guest, Professor David Ray Griffin. And you can get that for $100. Please make a call to 203-384-9756 203 384-9756 to get the From JFK to 9/11 premium. And my name's Ken McDermott Rowan. I'm here with Gus Condovero, and the name of our program, our series, is In Context. This special program for our fundraising drive is From JFK to 9/11.
Remember, you can always find us online at incontextreport.com. And on there we have the podcast of the shows and newsletter sign up so that you can get updates when we're going to be on the air, and the posts with all the documentation from the show after we've been on the air. So if you have any questions about what we've talked about, if you think we're BS and we're making stuff up, it's all going to be on there. All the documents we talk about, the YouTube clips, the audio clips, as much as I can compile. Today's going to be difficult because we're covering everything under the sun.
A to Z. Before you go on, Gus, would it be okay if we opened the phone lines in about 10 minutes or so? So callers, we'd love to hear from callers.
That'd be great.
That's what In Context is about, is a conversation with the listeners. So why don't you go ahead and, Gus, about the sheep dipping.
Yeah. All right. So while preparing, I was thinking about, again, the CIA and the infinite connections from them, and 9/11, and how it connected to some of the previous shows we've done, like Martin Luther King, JFK, Robert Kennedy, the deep state, things like that, and the infinite number of connections between the other people, the puppets in the government, the talking heads on mainstream media, and how we have this culture of fear, which is really what irks me partly, or one of the biggest things that irks me, because it's all a reaction, just like the Quran burning ceremony that was supposed to happen today, but then was canceled. I really want to see an investigation into that pastor and see if he's getting some funding by like the Rockefeller Foundation or something like that, because they always go after really weak-minded extremists on either side of the aisle.
Sure, sure. And I think often these people don't know.
No, they don't.
They don't know what's really going on. But it's the timing, of course, is interesting. It seems when 9/11 comes around, there's always some distracting stories, such as the mosque situation in New York.
Exactly.
Now it's been spending hours and hours and hours on network TV covering this debate over whether a mosque should be built in Lower Manhattan. Couldn't they tell us about Professor David Ray Griffin? Couldn't they tell us about Stephen Jones, about his research into the physics of the World Trade Center?
Yeah.
About Richard Gage and what the architects believe about the controlled demolition theory?
Exactly. The newspapers have actually done a semi-decent job on this mosque situation, because I don't think they realize what they're actually picking at, but it's a big story. They just don't realize it yet. And that's what it always is with the mainstream media and the general public, is they'll see the reports, but they're all segmented. They'll see like one little thing, they're like, huh, that's weird. And then they never remember to connect the dots from the last story that they heard. Because if they connected A to B, even though they're a year apart, you have to have some recall. You have to think that that's important and remember it in your mind. But you would be able to see, oh my gosh, that is really, really big news. Even though it's not on the front page of the story, instead there's a stupid football headline or sports or something or pop culture, you know, who's getting married or divorced or cheated on. That doesn't matter. This is what matters. Our freedom is what matters. This is our future. You know, the New York Post had a thing on their front page, and the New York Post by no means is investigative journalism. Okay,
right.
That's kind of a joke of a newspaper, but every once in a while they'll put something out there that's actually real news, and I don't think they realize it. That's the thing. Or because they're so discredited, their controllers feel like it's safe to put real news on there because people say that's a sports rag. You know, if it's on the front page, it may not be true. But what they actually uncovered was that the Ground Zero Mosque real estate was a sale was turned down for $18 million a year and a half before being sold to this Muslim organization for only $4.4 million. So they actually turned down $14 million difference. And then as a result, the owner of the land's son gets a cushy job with the people who purchased the real estate.
So what's that all about?
Exactly. What is that all about? I'd like to know. And then I have a report here, which I'll get into maybe a little later. But the headline is, Ground Zero Mosque Imam is Globalist Stooge. CFR member receives financial backing from who's who of global corporate elite. Again, all they're trying to do is stir up this culture of fear.
That's right. And divide and conquer.
Divide and
divide
conquer.
And they made Muslims and Arabs somehow the enemy. You hear an Arabic name and somehow this is equated with terrorism. And yet, as we're learning from people like David Ray Griffin and Stephen Jones and Richard Gage, they probably had nothing to do with it. The whole House of Cards is built on 9/11, which appears to have been,
and I'll say
it, it appears to have been a false flag operation. I wonder, could you play?
I got to get into some of these notes here before we do that.
Track number 12, though, on the false flag operations.
I'm going to play that one as soon as I just cover a couple quick points here. I want to go back to the underwear bomber, Mutalab. He was an interesting character because he was basically considered to be somewhat mentally unfit. You know, when he was seen at the airport, do you remember the lawyer whose testimony, the eyewitness testimony said that he saw Mutalab at the airport where'd they take off from?
Is this Detroit?
It's the one that was going to Detroit, but right. Denmark, I think. I can't remember. But Abdul Farouk Abdul Mutalab. He was seen without his passport. He approaches the table to board the plane to Detroit, and he doesn't have a passport, but he's accompanied by what's now been known as the sharp-dressed man, the SDM.
I see. And who is the sharp-dressed man?
The sharp-dressed man is what everyone wants to know.
So he's his handler.
He was his handler, yes. And he was described to be of Indian descent, and not Native American, but Middle Eastern Indian, Eastern.
Right.
And the guy spoke with an American accent because the person who was witness to this was an American, so he knew an American accent. And he said, this guy doesn't have a passport. He needs to get on the plane. He's from Africa. We do this all the time. And then the boarding agent says, well, you're going to have to speak to my manager. They escort them down the hall, never to be seen again until on the plane.
So this guy was put on the plane.
He was put on the plane despite not having a passport. He was searched in Kenya that they took off from? In Africa. And that was after his father had approached the CIA, the American embassy, where the CIA had a station chief, and told them that this kid was, you know, my son is getting mixed up with some extremists. I'm very concerned about him. He dropped out of college. I sent him to this nice college. I think it was in England, and where he attended some extremist mosques. I think it might have been the Brixton Mosque, which is the same mosque that Richard Reed attended. Richard Reed is the shoe bomber.
Yes.
And he had exchanged emails with the imam Anwar al-Awlaki. And Webster Tarpley calls him Anwar al-Awlaki, the CIA lackey. And he is an extremist imam. I think he has a presence on the internet where he has some kind of extreme teachings. And he has exchanged emails with not only Mutalab, but Richard Reed and the Fort Hood shooter, Major Hassan. Okay, so whenever you want to, and we use the term sheep dip, where you want to create a new identity for somebody who is a patsy.
Yes.
And and we saw that with the JFK assassination where Oswald was sheep-dipped by putting him in touch with these communists. And we don't even know the content of those conversations, but all we know is they spoke. So Awlaki is associated with extremism. You put these suckers in touch with him, and then through association, these guys are now extremists.
Yes.
And the Brixton Mosque is a heavily infiltrated mosque with a lot of MI5 in there, British MI5 and CIA, and they work very closely together. And both Mutalab and Reed use the military explosive PETN, which is connected to the Brixton Mosque, Awlaki, Reed, Mutalab, Hassan, they all are connected through these strings.
It makes me think that whenever you have an arrest of terror suspects, that these guys may be just loose cannons, they're chumps who've been managed and monitored by our intelligence network. And then when it's convenient for propaganda purposes, they're rounded up and they get front page headlines.
The U.S. government later on admitted that watch list members are sometimes allowed to board planes because they want to know where they're going to go, taking unnecessary risk with American lives. And they're saying we can gain more information by following these guys' trails than stopping them and actually enforcing the laws. So we see when laws are enforced, it's to hassle people who abide by the law.
Yeah, yeah.
It's not to actually stop anybody. When anyone is allowed to go through, it's because they're criminals. And we see a criminal government supporting criminals around the world. And it's we have this culture of fear, and you wonder why, because they think they can learn more by letting people actually commit terror.
How did the 9/11 supposed, you know, the alleged 9/11 hijackers get into the United States? I heard an interview a couple years ago on Amy Goodman's show where a State Department official in the Mideast said that he was ordered to grant visas to people he knew shouldn't come into the United States.
Exactly.
He turned them down, and then the order came down from on high, grant them visas. Obviously, they were part of some government, some national security program wanted them in. So,
and also, Awlaki is also connected to someone we're going to be talking about a little later, the infamous Hani Hanjour.
Yes, yes.
Pilot of Flight 77 that allegedly struck the Pentagon on 9/11.
Do you want to go to him now? Would you like to do Hani Hanjour now? Because we have a good clip on him from track 11.
We just got so much material. I hope we can get it all today.
Would you want to do Hani Hanjour, or you want to do the Griffin on the False Flag operation? It's important people hear these clips because they're part of the premium, and you can get the entire interview if you make a pledge of $100. Actually, there are five interviews included in the package.
Let's go to the Griffin on False Flag, because
okay,
I want to try to, before we get too far afield from where we started.
Okay, right. Okay.
So let me cue that up.
This clip is about 6 minutes, and then we'll give out the phone number, and maybe some people want to join the conversation who are the early risers on Saturday morning. You're listening to WPKN 89.5 FM, WPKN.org, where we stream live. And the name of this special program is From JFK to 9/11. Right. And I'm Ken McDermott Rowe. I'm here with Gus Condovero. Did the Bush administration ever come out with a report which said, this is why we've come to this conclusion, A, B, C, and D?
They promised they would. Colin Powell, when he was still Secretary of State, said he was going to produce a white paper giving the proof that Osama did it. He never did. So Tony Blair produced such a paper, but Blair admitted it wouldn't stand up in a court of law. So in other words, it was good enough to go to war, but not good enough to go to court. Bush then demanded that the Taliban hand over Osama, and the Taliban said, we'll be happy to, just give us some evidence that he was involved in 9/11, and the Bush administration refused. More recently, if you go on the FBI's most wanted terrorist website and look under Osama, spell it with a U, Osama bin Laden, you'll find that he's wanted for terrorist attacks on various American embassies, but he's not wanted for 9/11.
Why is that?
Well, Ed Haas, who has a report, you can find it on Google, called the Muckraker Report, called up the FBI and got a hold of Rex Toom, the head of investigative publicity, and said, well, why don't you list Osama as wanted for 9/11? And Toom said, because we have no hard evidence that Osama bin Laden was involved in 9/11.
And some of the physical evidence connecting the hijackers seems to be easily questioned. For example, the luggage that Mohammed Atta supposedly left at the airport or wasn't transferred to his plane in Boston that he was hijacking supposedly contained his passport, Will?
Yeah, this is what they used as their knockdown proof that Mohammed Atta was on Flight 11. They claim that he drove up from Boston to Portland the night before for some reason and then took a last-minute flight from Portland back down to Boston, which he could have easily missed. You know, the flight could have been delayed and the whole operation would have been screwed, so it would have been a really stupid thing. But anyway, this gave them an excuse to say that his luggage didn't make the plane, even though his plane was actually there an hour ahead of time. So then they say they got the luggage and opened it up, and here was all this incriminating evidence, you know, Qurans and last-minute instructions and so on, so Muhammad Atta's will. And, you know, if you were planning to fly a plane into a building and turn it into a fiery inferno, you would certainly take your will with you. And then they found the passport of one of the other alleged hijackers from Flight 11 under the World Trade Center. So somehow it popped out of the plane, or, you know, maybe when the plane burst into fire in this huge fireball, this passport, maybe it had been fireproofed because it wasn't even singed, was found. And there were different stories. Was it found after the towers collapsed or before? Then at Flight 93, at the crash site, what was supposed to be the crash site of it, although there was no sign of a plane, they said there was no sign because it went completely underground because it was coming down at this very steep angle at 580 miles an hour and hit this soft soil in Pennsylvania. And the plane went completely into the ground, so much so that you couldn't even see the tail sticking out. But fortunately, on the ground outside, you had one of the passports of one of the hijackers plus one of the red bandanas. And, of course, we had learned from some of the cell phone and airphone calls that the hijackers were wearing red bandanas. So that was proof. So it's hard to imagine, you know, you try to imagine this plane crashing into the ground at 580 miles an hour, and these things fall out. So evidently, you know, like most of us, if you're flying along at 580 miles an hour, you would have the windows open. So evidently that was it, and so the passport and the bandana
conveniently
just flew out the window just before the plane went into the ground. This is the level. I mean, this is such a Mickey Mouse operation. If the press would ever look at the details, it would, you know, they would say, look, this is just so obvious. This is standard false flag operation where there's some body that you want to go to war against, and so you stage an attack on yourself, and then you plant evidence that proves, you know, it was your enemy that did it. This is what Japan did when it was ready to go to war against China when it wanted to take over Manchuria, and this is what began the Pacific part of World War II. It's what Hitler did when he wanted to attack Poland. He dressed up a bunch of his troops as Poles, had them come across the border, and then he left a few dead bodies dressed in Polish uniforms and claimed that Poland had attacked Germany, so Germany was just doing a purely defensive operation against Poland. It's what we did when we wanted to start the Mexican-American War, when we started wanted to start the war in the Philippines. This is just the oldest story in the world.
It's not an original idea. Yes.
Yeah, and the fact that the evidence was planted at 9/11 is even more obvious than in these other cases.
Isn't that amazing how everything just interconnects?
It's the false flag operation is a venerable technique. I'd like to thank Joe from Shelton for calling in to support us with a $100 pledge, and he's going to receive the premium, which is available today, a special premium for this show, From JFK to 9/11. It includes the book, The New Pearl Harbor, by David Ray Griffin, who you just heard in that interview I did for History Counts. And it also includes five History Counts episodes, including our hour-long interview with Professor David Ray Griffin, as well as the other leading intellectual in the 9/11 independent investigative movement, Stephen Jones. It includes my interviews on the CIA and the assassination of President Kennedy, the execution of Martin Luther King, who killed Bobby Kennedy. Those are half-hour interviews, one-on-one with authors who go in great detail about very explosive material having to do with those assassinations. And it also includes two audio clips by Peter Beauchamp, Back to Dallas, 1963, and Back to 9/11. And you can receive that that premium by calling 203-384-9756. That's 203-384-9756. Just ask for the premium for from JFK to 9/11, and I guarantee the information you're going to hear on that on those CDs and the information that we're presenting, Gus Canavero and I are presenting this morning, is information you are not going to hear anywhere else on the radio dial. You're not going to hear it from the network TV. You're only going to hear it here on WPKN, and that's because of your generosity. We depend on you listeners. We do not depend on corporate advertising, corporate underwriting. We depend on your generosity to keep us on the air. And believe me, we run a lean ship here. This station reaches something like 2 million people, and our operating expenses are something like $250,000 a year, which if you compare it to a comparable commercial station is a very tiny amount of money. We have total of one full-time employee and an assistant who comes in part-time in the morning to help him out. That's it. Everybody else here is a volunteer. Gus and I are volunteers. The other programmers, our phone helper in the back, Bonnie's a volunteer. And we do it because we believe in democracy. It's as simple as that. We believe in government by the people. So we consider ourselves privileged that you allow us to be on the air, that you support us with your generosity. So thanks for calling 203-384-9756. Over to you, Gus.
Yeah, call in and vote for public affairs. You know, this is a really important topic we're talking about. We're going to be bringing new topics to you every month. We're going to be on twice a month as it stands right now. It's the first Wednesday of the month at 6:30 p.m. and the first Sunday of the month at 10 p.m. For about 40-minute shows, 40-minute shows. I just want to finish up really quick on the last things we were talking about. We're talking about Farouk Abdul-Muttalib and Richard Reed, also known as the Underwear Bomber and the Shoe Bomber, because people are too stupid to be able to remember their actual names. So we have to give them silly names, like cartoon characters or something, like villains. And because that's really all they are. Terrorists are just cartoon character villains. You know, sometimes they're successful, but it seems like they're unsuccessful far more often because their handlers are the ones that provide them with the bombs. They pick out these patsies that are just a bunch of fools, like the guys who were supposedly setting up to bomb the synagogues in New York, in Queens. They were going to bomb one. They had like bombs that were full of like flour or something like that. They were fakes. Because they were given to them by the FBI. They sought them out. They riled them up. They told them this is a great thing to do. You should do it. You guys will be, you know, you'll be memorialized in Muslim folklore. They go ahead and do it. They're arrested because they're just a bunch of suckers. And the guys from Miami who were supposedly going to go bomb the Sears Towers, none of them had ever even been to Chicago except for one of them.
That's right.
Who was there once.
That's right. But the important thing is they get the headlines. And let's face it, if somebody was determined to blow something up, and perish the thought that there are people out there
right. Who
want to do this. But if somebody was determined to do that, to do this to us, I mean, we are an open society, and despite all the Homeland Security and whatnot, and it could be done. But a lot of this
Not that I poo-poo the fact there are people out there who are extremists. I believe there are terrorists in the world. They exist. They're real. But the reason why they hate us is something for debate. And the ones that are successful, those are also up for debate. Because I believe that even though there are people out there who want to kill us, who want to blow up our buildings, I don't think they have the means to do it. I think that the only time that they're successful is when our law enforcement allows them to do it or perpetrates it themselves. Because they need that stuff to happen in order to get their mission accomplished. And when we're talking about how the fact that Farouk Abdul-Muttalib was allowed to board the airplane even though he didn't have a passport. I'm talking about how Richard Reed was allowed to board the airplane.
So the next
even
time,
though he had set off security measures. I'm talking about how the 9/11 hijackers were able to board planes, even though they set off metal detectors.
So the next time you're in the airport and they're giving you the fifth degree, you kind of wonder what it's all about.
Yeah, because my belt buckle is right. Steel or something like that. You know, and the Israeli security company, ICNS, is the security company in charge of Paris, where Richard Reed was allowed to board, and the Amsterdam airport, where the underwear bomber Muttalib was allowed to board. And so is there a connection there? I don't know. I'm not pointing fingers. I'm just telling you what the facts is. And then the suggestions that are given out by our government are things like body scanners, which rip apart your DNA. It violates your Fourth Amendment because they don't have a warrant. They tell you that it's voluntary, but then they force you and bully you into do it and accuse you of hiding something if you don't want to go through these damaging body scanners.
Who's in charge here? I guess
Michael Chertoff is the guy who invested heavily into body scanners. His brother brother or cousin is the one who owns the company. Chertoff is a heavy investor in the company. Chertoff, we know, is the former Secretary of Homeland Security, one of the police state departments that was created in response to 9/11.
Right.
And it's all about making cash.
It is fairly simple when it comes to motivation.
All you got to do is just scare the hell out of people. All you have to do is invent something that is a possible solution, even if it's a crappy one, and you say, look at all the problems out here. You create the problem. You provide the reaction, you know, by manufacturing the reaction, by controlling it through the media.
You sell the solution.
You provide a solution.
You sell a solution.
That's actually called the Hegelian dialectic. Problem, reaction, solution.
I see. And the solution involves profit to the guy who created the problem.
Exactly. It's not an actual solution because the body scanners wouldn't actually pick up PETN.
We don't actually want to end this thing. We want to keep it going as long as possible. Gus, why don't we give out the phone number?
And go ahead.
It's 203. This is for the call-in line now.
Right.
203-336-9756. If you'd like to join the discussion on our special program from JFK to 9/11 here on WPKN 89.5 FM, streaming live at WPKN.org, that call-in number again is 203-336-9756. 203-336-9756 to join the discussion with Gus Candivero and me, I'm Ken McDermott Rowe.
Now, I've got a couple of clips I want to play. First one is the Eisenhower farewell speech on the military-industrial complex because it connects directly to what we were just talking about with people in the government providing the solution to manufactured problems. And listen to his words. They're a warning that ring true today, and obviously we're unheeded. After that, I'm going to play another clip. We have a call. Should we take that first?
Sure, yeah.
Okay. All right.
Hello, caller. You're on the air at WPKN from JFK to 9/11. What's on your mind?
How you doing? I was just listening to part of that discussion, and I just have to say this, and I'm pretty sure it's common sense, but the root of all evil is money.
Absolutely.
If we never created money, which that's, you know, unfortunately the way the world is run, none of this would happen because it's all cash. Like you said, it's all money. Everything happens because of money.
It is all money. I mean,
I
want money just to
create our own problem.
I want money as much as anybody, but I'm not going to kill somebody for it, you know. So it has a lot to do with people's morality as well, too, doesn't it?
Oh, absolutely. But it still, when it comes down to it, that is it. Period. There's no way around it. And unfortunately, we created it. Whether there's good people and bad people in the world, the people that are bad can't get it as easily, and that's the reason why they do what they do, because it's the only thing they know. Death, destruction, it's horrible.
It is horrible, and I hear how you mean those words, because I can hear it in your voice.
I'm just going to the bottom line of the whole thing.
Right.
And you know,
how do we break
the way unless we go back to working on deeds and, you know, do good deeds and get credits?
Yeah, because
it doesn't work like that anymore.
I can't personally advocate a communist system, because what that ends up doing is it uses power as a corruption method instead of money. You know, and so, like, people will say capitalism is the cause of the crime, and say, you know, that's why we have destruction in South America, Africa, and Asia. But I'll say, well, you know, if it wasn't money, it would just be power, because, I mean, the people who really control the world, they want – money doesn't matter to them, yeah, really. It's the power.
How do we break this cycle, caller? How do we get – how do we –
it's a difficult thing. Look at the piracy going on. You know, the piracy. Look at the millions of dollars they take to ships, but the ransom is unbelievable.
You mean off of Somalia, the Somalian pirates?
Right. These people have no money. They'll do whatever they have to do to get that money. It has nothing to do with power. That has to do with money.
Well, okay,
that's
I understand.
That's another situation.
Right. Thank you very much for the call.
Thanks a lot, caller.
At the root of things, it's money, because you have to be able to take care of yourself. He's right about that. At the very base level, you know, if you've got nothing, you need cash. You got to take care of yourself. You have to have the ability to take care of your family.
But then how much is enough?
How much is enough? At a certain level, I think that it becomes power. Because they'll drop $1 million on a birthday party. It's not the cash to them. I think it's the power. It's the ability to be able to force somebody to do something against their will. And that's why we see the world elite when they, you know, like Al Gore was recently caught forcing himself on a masseuse.
Right.
And to him, he's got loads of cash. Obviously, it's a subliminal power thing.
Well,
with him.
Yeah, obviously, that's
it. Corrupts you to the
problem
point
there.
It corrupts you to the point where you become a twisted demonic soul.
Well, why don't we go to the General Eisenhower, President Eisenhower's speech as he left office in 1960.
Awesome.
Ladies and gentlemen, the President of the United States.
Good evening, my fellow Americans. We now stand 10 years past the midpoint of a century that has witnessed 4 major wars among great nations. Until the latest of our world conflicts, the United States had no armaments industry. American makers of plowshares could, with time and as required, make swords as well. But we can no longer risk emergency improvisation of national defense. We have been compelled to create a permanent armaments industry of vast proportions. Added to this, 3.5 million men and women are directly engaged in the defense establishment. Now, this conjunction of an immense military establishment and a large arms industry is new in the American experience. The total influence, economic, political, even spiritual, is felt in every city, every state house, every office of the federal government. We recognize the imperative need for this development. Yet we must not fail to comprehend its grave implications. Our toil, resources, and livelihood are all involved. So is the very structure of our society. In the councils of government, we must guard against the acquisition of unwarranted influence, whether sought or unsought, by the military-industrial complex. The potential for the disastrous rise of misplaced power exists and will persist. We must never let the weight of this combination endanger our liberties or democratic processes. We should take nothing for granted. Only an alert and knowledgeable citizenry can compel the proper meshing of the huge industrial and military machinery of defense with our peaceful methods and goals, so that security and liberty may prosper together.
Of course, that was President Dwight D. Eisenhower, a Republican president, which shows you this concern about the overwhelming power of the military-industrial complex. It's not a party issue. It's not a left-right issue, as Gus and I often say.
Call.
We have a call now?
Yeah, you want to take a call?
Oh, sure. Caller, you're on. Caller, you're on the air. The WPKN from JFK to 9/11 program.
Hello, Ken. Hello, Gus. Good morning.
Oh, good morning.
Good morning. Thank you for calling.
Oh, my pleasure, my pleasure. But thank you for the wonderful programming that you've been providing.
You're welcome.
I was listening to Eisenhower's speech on your show.
Yeah.
And one thing that struck me is nothing's new in history. As the old adage goes, history goes on and repeats itself. What's really interesting is I guess you'd call it the establishment or the elite at the top. They don't make any of this secret, any of this. The military-industrial complex, people tend to view these theories or beliefs as conspiracy theories or something of the shadowy underworld. But in reality, I mean, the project for the newest American century, I actually found Rebuilding America's Defenses on their website.
It's right there.
Right.
Anyone can read it in plain view.
And in fact, on page 57, I believe, it even states quite clearly on page 57, page 57, chapter 5, basically states that my computer's frozen.
No problem.
That what is needed for this radical change to take place is a new Pearl Harbor, as you stated earlier in the show. But
exactly.
It's there in plain view.
And if you look at that, a third-party person who's just analyzing this and saying, well, let me go and look this up and see what the dissenters say, see if there's a different point of view, because I've done this. And you'll look it up, and there'll be supposed debunkers out there saying, oh, come on, it's mixed in with a missile defense shield thing. They're just saying that's what it would take. They're not saying that's what they want to do. And it's saying, look, man, you look these things up. They are all over the place. The UN has them. These right-wing extremist neoconservative think tanks have these statements that they put up there. Zbigniew Brzezinski has things in his book, The Grand Chessboard, about the exact mirror statement about a new Pearl Harbor. He doesn't use those phrases, but he says a polarizing event that would bring America together to oppose the outside world. And all they mean is their end game is to just have one massive control grid.
Caller, what's the sense in your community? Are people questioning 9/11, or does nobody question it? Is it just a given that the government's explanation is accurate?
To be fair, I mean, most people, human nature being what it is, most people, at least that I've come into contact with, blindly accept it. These include folks from pensioners to college students. The vast majority of people I know blindly accept it, but that's because they haven't been presented with a reasonable alternative explanation. I mean, to be fair, your show is really the first that's really mass media, if you will. I mean, you're on the radio, you're public, you're syndicated, so you're really the first voice of another perspective. I mean, because what most people hear is, I saw on the History Channel while I was at work, that, you know, they're debunking 9/11 pretty much, debunking any opposition theory, and that's what most people hear. That's what the average person will hear.
And those programs are total jokes. You know, like Popular Mechanics did a complete, you know, wash job on 9/11, and they did a complete misrepresentation of the structure of the World Trade Center, just saying that it was a big telescope. You know,
so much
was just going to collapse as soon as anything happened.
Never once did they mention the report by the New York City Fire Department, by the Fire Marshal's Office, stating that the towers could not have been brought down by a plane. I mean, this is the New York City Fire Marshal's Office. Popular Mechanics presumes to supersede the New York City Fire Marshal's Office.
Well, isn't it interesting that the administration never defends itself? It uses surrogates like this magazine article to come out. No, you never see people from the administration come out. No one at a press conference ever stands up and says, President Obama, what do you think of the fact that over 1,000 architects and engineers believe that the World Trade Center was brought down into controlled demolition? What would happen to that reporter?
That's what you would get. Next question.
Oh, well, it'd be almost like the administration of William McKinley admitting that the USS Maine may not have been blown up by a Spanish mine, which archaeologists are actually discovering right now.
Well, for our callers who may not be familiar with that period, what was the significance of the blowing up of the ship, the Maine?
Remember the Maine.
The blowing up the Maine occurred in 1898. And it was a U.S. naval vessel stationed off the coast of Cuba, and it was supposedly blown up by a Spanish sea mine. At which point, the United States used it as a pretext to go to war with Spain and annex Cuba. And interestingly enough, used it also as an excuse to annex the Philippines, which is on the crucial coal route to China. Eerily enough, similar to Afghanistan being on the crucial oil route from the and natural gas route from the Caspian Sea. Mm-hmm.
So there's a key economic advantage in controlling the Philippines in order to get to China.
Precisely, and it's taking on a weaker empire, too. I mean, again, Spain at the time was a dying empire. Its heyday had long since passed.
They were ripe for the picking.
Precisely. and America was a new emerging industrial nation.
So remember the Maine rallied the peace of people. Okay.
Exactly. There was never any question after that point.
Well, thank you very much for your call, caller. We really appreciate your joining us.
Yes,
and we'll
thank
speak
you
again, I hope. Bye-bye now.
Bye-bye. Oh, it was my pleasure. My pleasure.
Thanks again. Go ahead, caller.
This is Joe for Ken.
Yes.
Our daughters met recently.
Oh, hi, Joe. Joe is up in Massachusetts, and I assume you're listening to us on the stream.
Yes, sir.
Oh, well, thank you very
much
for calling
in
to From JFK to 9/11, our fundraising special here at WPKN.
At least we know the stream works.
That's great. Yes, thanks, Joe.
What's on your mind this morning?
Well, I have a question. Given the planned demolition scenario and it being assumed that Barack Obama is clearly knowledgeable about the situation,
potentially,
what should he now do to make this knowledge basically known to the media? And to follow that up, is it currently wise for this information to be made public, considering the tense underlying power balance that exists.
That's a fascinating question, because it would have dozens of implications. The first thing he could do, and this would...
Well, first of all, the information is public.
It is public.
It's just not acknowledged by the government.
No, because there's such a culture of insult, where if you question the insides, the official story, you are a terrorist yourself. You're a dissenter. And if he really wanted to get out of the wars, unlike what he's actually doing with Iraq, which is just a renaming of soldiers and redeploying them elsewhere and replacing them with private contractors who are not bound by any of our code of conduct.
Right.
If he really wanted to get out of the wars, he would say, I think we need an independent investigation into 9/11, because some things have come across my desk that have made me question our auspices of going to war, and then have a truly independent investigation, not one that was co-opted like the 9/11 Commission, which was a total joke. And then they would present something and say, look, yeah, Able Danger brought us information that said, you know, we knew who the terrorists were, that they were going to strike within weeks, and George Bush chose not to listen to it. The CIA, the FBI, they all let this stuff happen. And then he could easily just say, well, look, you know, we're wasting $1 trillion over in these wars, killing innocent people for absolutely no reason. Maybe if we left them alone, they would stop trying to bomb us.
9/11 is the keystone for this whole war. And any president who came in who wanted to return to a traditional foreign policy that people like Ron Paul talk about, which is that we of non-interference, could unravel this whole global war simply by, I think, very quickly by acknowledging that 9/11.
And instead of trying to force people,
flag operation,
like spanking children, into living the way we think they should live, we could live as an example so that they could adopt our Constitution and they could have their own peaceful revolution, adopt our Constitution, be our natural allies around the world because of idealistic representations instead of economic relationships.
But in my sense is that Barack Obama, essentially, while he campaigned as an agent of change, really was a really represents continuity with the Bush foreign policy.
Well, he's a con man.
So, well, you might say, and he doesn't really want to change, because 9/11, if you recognize the truth about 9/11, it would bring about dramatic changes.
Well, yes, okay. Well, I have a follow-up on that.
Please,
sure.
Go ahead.
Assuming that, he isn't so involved, but that he walked into the White House and was presented this information and was shown, hey, this is the way it is, and uh-huh. and just stood back and said, whoa, and rethought the whole thing, as opposed to being somebody who, you know, already was aware of pieces of it. I know he's not a naive man, but, I mean, this is the type of thing that's so deeply interwoven that, you know, and it's so protected that, you know, there's a lot of dangers involved here. Like, for instance, would he be a target of violence? Would there be like so much confusion in the public with this being, you know, clearly proven and exposed wide enough so that everybody could see it, so that there was internal anarchy.
It would be such a dramatic revelation for the veil to be lifted, for people to see the crime that was committed. That would be, wow, that would change the whole way people look at that.
Well,
he asks
a multi-level question there that, you know, would he be exposing himself to violence? Well, of course he would.
Of course. Because look at what JFK, you know, that's part of our premium. And listeners, for $100, you get a contribution to WPKN. You're going to get a premium package that includes interviews, one-on-one interviews on the JFK assassination, the Bobby Kennedy assassination, Martin Luther King, and two. Caller, thank you very much for joining us. You'll get two in-depth interviews on 9/11 with Peter Ray Griffin and Stephen Jones, and you'll also get audio mixes. Plus, you're going to get the book, The New Pearl Harbor, by our guest, Griffin, who started off this whole independent investigation of 9/11. So that's a premium for $100, and you can get it by calling our phone volunteer, Bonnie, at 203-384-9756. That's 203-384-9756. 1-888-384-9756. We're playing clips from these shows this morning, but you can get all five History Counts episodes, plus the book, The New Pearl Harbor, plus the audio mixes by Peter Beauchamp for a pledge of $100. So please call and support WPKN. Support the independent news that you're getting here by calling 203-384-9756. And I believe we're going to play another clip now.
Yeah, we're going to play a couple clips. I just want to send a quick message out to our last caller and just say, just to finish that up, if you question whether Obama knew or didn't know before coming into office whether 9/11 happened the way we are describing, I ask you to look up Wayne Madsen. It's M-A-D-S-E-N, who did a special investigative report, just came out recently. It's called All in the Family, Obama's Personal CIA Family Ties.
That's fascinating.
His mother, his grandfather, stepfather, and his real father, Obama. All CIA assets. So if you don't think that he was created like from a recipe, practically from birth,
it's scary to
be the Manchurian candidate president, you know, I ask you to look into that. Wayne Madsen. All right, so we're going to play. Let me figure out which.
Why don't we do a Peter Beauchamp's Back to 9/11, that audio mix. It's track number two.
Here we go. Oh, maybe.
You're listening to WPK.
Overhead, and then all of a sudden I thought it sounded kind of louder. Then I looked up, and all of a sudden it smashed right dead into the center of the World Trade Center.
This just happened. Saw a twin engine plane flying right into the Trade Center.
We heard the explosion, and I'll never forget that explosion. I'll tell you that. We were just under some scaffolding.
I had a perfect view, and the plane was coming in. I noticed it a second before it hit the building.
Train entering the center. I lost myself and never came back. Took a trip around the world and never came back. Black silhouettes, crisscross tracks, never came back.
They come by and say, what happened?
A moment that will change everyone's life in this country, certainly here in New York City.
And you just got to say, something hit the building, and then something hit both buildings.
It's like a commercial plane, not a small plane. And I kept thinking, this is too low, it's too low, it's too low. And then it went right in.
Me and my coworkers were sitting at our desks. All of a sudden, the building just swayed.
I know there are 50,000 people who work in the World Trade Center. I know that every ambulance and every fire company in the city and has been called in and dispatched there.
We carried a bunch of people that we found laying in the debris. It was complete darkness. We stumbled over some people. We picked them up and carried them across the street.
My name is Joe Macaluso. I just want my mother and my family to know I'm alive. I was on the 34th floor when the planes hit. We didn't know what happened.
Amazing grace, how sweet the sound that saved a wretch like me. I once was lost, but now I'm found, was blind, but now I see. What grace that taught my heart to feel, grace my fears release. How precious did that grace appear the hour I first believed.
It's an unbelievable sight. I've never seen something like this. And I'm 20 years on this job. This is the worst I've ever seen it before. It's unbelievable, the devastation.
I wasn't there because I dropped my baby off at school for my five-year-old's first day of school, but that means that I get there late. That means I get to be alive. And anybody who got there early doesn't get to. It's unthinkable.
I think from time to time, history put us at test to see how can we handle uninvited catastrophes, unbelievable agonies, and remain what we should be, a people that believes in the basics of our existence, namely the foundation of values of the gospel.
Hi, good morning. This is Ken McDermott Rowe. I'm here with Gus Cantavero. If you just joined us, you're listening to In Context, a special fundraising special that we've put together from JFK to 9/11 for the benefit of our station, WPKN 89.5 FM, and we stream live at WPKN.org. And thank you very much for listening. We've created a premium to go with the special. It's called From JFK to 9/11, and the premium includes, for a $100 pledge, the book The New Pearl Harbor, written by David Ray Griffin, as well as a package, a 3D set of five History Counts programs. These are one-on-one in-depth interviews. One is called The CIA and the Assassination of President Kennedy. Another is The Execution of Martin Luther King. A third is Who Killed Bobby Kennedy? And then we have two interviews on 9/11 with the leading independent experts on 9/11. There are one-on-one interviews that I did with Professor Stephen Jones, the physicist, in a program called Why Indeed Did the World Trade Center Collapse?, which looks at the physics of the collapse of the World Trade Center, and he concludes that it was a controlled demolition. And also with Professor David Ray Griffin, the author of the book, The New Pearl Harbor, we did a one-hour interview called 9/11 Unanswered Questions, where this man, who is really the seminal work on the independent 9/11 investigation movement, he goes into many details regarding the attack, including the airline pilot, the failure of the Air Force to respond, what happened to the Pentagon, the lack of evidence against the accused. So we have those available, and I'd like to play a clip, if we can, from the execution of Martin Luther King, which is on track four. And this is a clip. If you get the call for the premium, and the number to call is 203-384-9756. That's 203-384-9756. Ask for the JFK to 9/11 premium for $100, and you'll get all of the entire interviews in each of these five shows, plus the book, plus two entertaining audio mixes relating to 1963 and 2001 by Peter Beauchamp. So the clip you're going to hear now is from the interview, The Execution of Martin Luther King, with William Pepper, who was the attorney for the King family in a lawsuit for civil damage for wrongful death, which he brought in Tennessee in 1999.
It was an 8-man sniper unit that left Camp Shelby, Mississippi, and left at about 5:30 in the morning and drove into Memphis. And various members of the unit took up their appointed positions. And their task was, so they thought, was to take out Andrew Young and Martin King. And Andrew Young was a bit of a surprise, but they had two sniper teams, and one of them, the one on top of the railroad building, was to take out Andrew Young. And that, they thought, was their job. And they were in position and ready to go. And then what happened was the sniper was a civilian sniper. And they were the backup, in my view, to that civilian sniper. The civilian sniper fired from the bushes and accomplished the task. And so they were not needed. They were told to disengage and withdraw.
Now, the King family in 97 came to support James Ray's legal maneuverings for a trial. What was the result of that?
There were two trials, and one can say, connected with this whole thing. One back in 93, which related to evidence that we had at the time, and it was actually a television trial, but it was unscripted, and it was bitterly fought with an independent jury and a former federal judge presiding. With the minimum of evidence we had at that time, it took that jury 7.5 hours to find James not guilty. was a shock to Hickman. Ewing, in particular, was the prosecutor and had former U.S. attorney in Memphis and former, later to be a Ken Starr prosecutor against Bill Clinton. So that was one then, and that, by the way, opened the floodgates to a lot of information that we didn't have that started coming. Okay, the second trial, the one to which you're referring, was the civil trial, which was an actual civil trial.
So you chose a civil route then?
I chose the civil route whereby the King family would sue Lloyd Jowers and others, including agents of the United States and agents of the state of Tennessee and city of Memphis, for a conspiracy to kill Martin King. Jowers was the key defendant in that trial.
Did they seek damages, monetary?
No, they only sought, well, they did, but only to the extent that, it was required to pay the burial costs.
And that trial,
the equivalent of the burial cost.
And that trial took place in 1999 in Memphis?
Yeah, it took place in 1999 in Memphis, and it lasted for 30 days, had 70 witnesses. Probably never before in history has an assassination been so well documented and detailed under oath.
And what was the jury's verdict?
The jury found for the King family that a conspiracy existed and took them 59 minutes. And they only attributed 30% of the responsibility to Lloyd Jowers, and the rest they attributed to the government.
So they determined that Lloyd Jowers participated in the conspiracy, but that others, including government agencies, also participated.
Yes, absolutely.
And what was the media's reaction to the verdict?
Silence. The media's reaction to most things has been silence. There was one article in the New York Times, and then it went away. The media stayed in the hallway through most of the trial, not hearing the evidence. When Mrs. King testified, or Andrew Young, or Dexter, they came in, took note of that testimony. But when the real hard evidence was being presented, they were, for the most part, not capable, not willing to report it. So the American people, most American people, don't even know the trial took place.
Hi, you're listening to WPKN, 89.5 FM, Bridgeport, Connecticut, streaming live, WPKN.org. This is Ken McDermott Rowe. I'm here with Gus Cantavero. This is a special fundraising program called From JFK to 9/11. You just heard a portion of an interview with William Pepper on the assassination. He calls it the execution of Martin Luther King. The entire interview is available on our premium. It also includes interviews on the CIA and the assassination of President Kennedy, who killed Bobby Kennedy in 1968, as well as two in-depth interviews on 9/11 with the two leading scholars in the 9/11 movement, Professor Stephen Jones, who discusses why indeed did the World Trade Center collapse, and David Ray Griffin, whose program, an hour-long interview, is called 9/11 Unanswered Questions. These five interviews are available along with the book The New Pearl Harbor by the guest David Ray Griffin, the seminal work in the independent investigation of 9/11. In addition, we'll put in with the premium two audio mixes by our general manager, Peter Beauchan, and you can get those for a pledge to WPKN of $100 by calling 203-384-9756. That's 203-384-9756. Our phone volunteer, Bonnie, came in here this morning at 6 a.m. and has been taking your calls, and we really appreciate them because, as you know, this kind of information just heard about the assassination of Martin Luther King, it's not broadcast on the TV networks. It should be. It's basic information about a very important event that happened in American history, and the American public believes the opposite of what you heard today. They believe that James Earl Ray killed Martin Luther King, that he was a lone gunman operating out of bigotry. And the truth of the matter, which was determined by a court in 1999 in Tennessee in an action brought by the King family, was that Martin Luther King was killed by a large group of people and the government, including a man named Lord Jowers. But the jury said 70% of the blame for the killing went on other people, including government officials. And during the trial, as you'll learn, if you hit the entire interview as part of our premium, you'll hear about the military intelligence group that went down there to Memphis to set up their guns. You'll hear about the man in the bushes behind the grill were supposedly James Earl Ray's shot, but actually the shot was from a man outside the grill that he got into a Memphis police car, witnesses said, and left the scene of the crime. You'll learn about how the FBI for years targeted Martin Luther King and how military groups were set up in the early 60s to neutralize important African-American leaders. So this is really important information that I think people should know, that you'll want to know, and you can get that by calling 203-384-9756, pledging $100 to WPKN, and you'll get this terrific premium package of 5 History Counts programs, a CD set, 3 CD set. You'll get the new Pearl Harbor, David Ray Griffin, the seminal book on the 9/11 independent investigation movement. You'll get the audio mixes by Peter Beauchamp, and you get that all by calling 203-384-9756, and we thank you for your support, because you can hear this information. You can turn the dial today on this September 11th, and you will not hear anywhere else on this dial. You will not hear it on your network TV, any place on TV, what you're hearing today on WPKN, and that's because of your generous support. We are listener-sponsored. We are not constrained by corporations who put commercials on the air here. It's you put us on the air. And we thank you very much. So please give a call to 203-384-9756.
Ken, with the assassinations of Robert Kennedy, John Kennedy, Martin Luther King, Malcolm X, all these popular figures from the 60s, do you think the ultimate goal, even though what we know, each one of those people challenged the establishment, they all encouraged dissent, challenge the government. Do you think the CIA was successful because they have created such a culture of ignorance?
I think the answer to that is yes, which is one reason why in History Counts, in that series that I did for 3 years here at WPKN, and now in this current program, we give a lot of attention to covert operations, including assassinations, because unfortunately, assassinations change history, and they're not talked about. They're usually covered up. We did a show on the ancient Roman Republic with Martin, with Michael Parenti, the historian, the political analyst, and he showed how every significant populist leader in ancient Rome was assassinated by mobs organized by the large landowners. And the big issue back then was that the large landowners had illegally acquired all the common farmland, impoverishing the Roman yeomen. The Roman farmers upon which the Roman Republic had been based. So these are, unfortunately, are very important events. And think how different the country would have been if the Kennedy brothers hadn't been killed, if Martin Luther King hadn't been killed. And as William Pepper tells about in his interview with me, that summer, he was killed in April. That summer, he was planning on leading a poor person's march to Washington. And they were going to encamp. Thousands and thousands of people were going to encamp in Washington and demand an end to the Vietnam War.
And that's white and black people. It wasn't a racial thing.
That is such a key point, Gus. Martin Luther King was not a black separatist. He was not a black leader. He was an American leader, and he believed in the cooperation.
He just happened to be black.
He happened to be black, the brotherhood of the blacks and the whites. And and he also came out and he saw the civil rights movement was part of a bigger puzzle. At a famous speech he gave in Riverside Church that many listeners may have heard in April of 1967, he brought together the anti-war movement with the civil rights movement. And he said, there can be no socialist justice without peace. So he brought together these two great movements, and he brought together white working families and black working families. He was in Memphis, Tennessee to support a strike by sanitation workers. So he was bringing it all together, and I think that's why he was such a threat and why he was removed.
You know, today we've got, like I said, a culture of disinformation and ignorance, and, you know, they certainly create an easier flock to manage.
Yeah.
You know,
yeah.
I think the CIA and our deep state black operation, you know, hidden secret government, you know, because the government that we have is really just a show organization. They clearly have no power. You know, the Congress goes to the Federal Reserve and says, where'd all the money go? And they say, I can't tell you.
That's right.
And they can't even subpoena Ben Bernanke and ask to force him to answer their questions. They have no authority over
it. It becomes more and more a nominal government, with the real power being exercised by people behind closed doors who represent large corporate interests.
The shadow government is the word I was looking for.
I mean,
for.
That's one, what motivates me, and I think you, even though we don't necessarily come from the same political perspective any more than Ron Paul and Dennis Kucinich come from the same political perspective, is that we believe in popular government. We believe in the rule by the people. And if the public policies should be made by the people in open debate. It shouldn't be made by well-connected bigwigs behind closed doors.
With minority rights being protected at all times.
That's
just
right.
Because you know, you're in the minority doesn't mean that you need to bend over and have yourself trampled, you know, because it's not – I don't believe in the 51% ruling.
Well, that's why we have a constitutional democracy.
Right.
And
people's
rights are protected. We're an individualistic people.
Democracy was famously described as two wolves and a sheep voting on what's for dinner. without that constitution to protect the sheep,
That's a key part. We have to respect minorities' rights and all play by the same rules. Maybe we can take a listen to an excerpt from the show on the assassination of Bobby Kennedy. It's called Who Killed Bobby? And it's an interview with Shane O'Sullivan, who carefully examined the assassination of Bobby Kennedy in 1968 in a film he made and in a book, the title Who Killed Bobby?
The movie was RFK Must Die as well. It's a great movie.
Right.
Now, according to the eyewitnesses, where was Sirhan standing in relation to Robert Kennedy when he made the shots?
Well, the key thing is that Sirhan was placed in front of Kennedy. The witness distances varied, but they were between the barrel of Sirhan's gun was 1.5 to 5 feet in front of Kennedy. Also, you know, we have Euchre and Frank Burns, who was an aide to the Kennedy campaign, actually standing between Sirhan and Robert Kennedy. So that would seem to imply that he couldn't have got to the contact distance at which the shots were fired.
In fact, some of the eyewitnesses you cite, Valerie Schulte, gives Sirhan's distance at 9 feet. Pete Hamill, the writer, said 7 to 8 feet. Although they did go down, it seems like the average was in the 3 feet range. You had some that were even further away than that.
Yeah, I mean, I think, you know, there's some of the key witnesses who were literally right there and were standing between Sirhan and between Kennedy tended to say between, say, 1.5 to 3 feet. That was the distance between the barrel of the gun and Kennedy's head. But then you had other witnesses. Yeah, I mean, it went up to 9 feet, I think, in Valerie Schulte's case. But there was no single witness who placed the gun right next to Kennedy's head, as the autopsy would indicate. It must have been fired in that position.
And they also said that the gun was held how relative to the ground? Parallel to the ground or pointed down?
Well, this is it as well. So all the witnesses saw Sirhan's gun held roughly parallel to the ground, so on the horizontal, aiming at Kennedy, but again from this distance, muzzle distance of 1.5 to 5 feet. When you look at the autopsy results of Dr. Thomas Noguchi, he says that all three shots that hit Kennedy were fired from behind. The gun, because of the powder burns on Kennedy and on his coat, was held at contact distance, which means either contact with Kennedy's body or an inch away, and also in a sharp upward angle. So really steep upward angle, almost as if the gunman is in a crouched position below Kennedy at the time of shooting.
So the L.A. coroner, Dr. Thomas Noguchi, cited the three bullets where in relation to Senator Kennedy? The ones
so basically we have three shots that actually hit Robert Kennedy's body. One was fired an inch behind the right ear. It penetrated the brain and fragmented. So we had many bullet fragments literally in Kennedy's brain, and that was the fatal shot that killed the senator. And then we have a couple of other shots under the right armpit that seemed to be fired at a time when Kennedy's arm was raised, almost as if he had now heard the gunfire and was trying to react and take cover. So we'd never been able to determine what the order of the shots were in terms of when the fatal shot came in relation to the ones under the armpit, but certainly they came in a sharp upward trajectory from behind, and there were three of them. So if we believe Carl Euchre, it couldn't have been Sirhan who fired those shots because his arm was diverted away after the second shot, and also Sirhan was obviously in the wrong position because he was 1.5 to 5 feet in front of the senator, whereas the fatal shot seems to have come from 1 inch behind.
Mr. William Harper, who was a former technical investigation chief for the Office of Naval Intelligence, did his own investigation, and in December 1971, he wrote a report. What was his theory?
Well, his theory was that clearly there were two firing positions, because if you look objectively at the evidence, which I think is not something that the LAPD did at the time prior to the trial,
you can see that, you know, we have Sirhan obviously seen by quite a number of witnesses firing his gun. I believe he did fire shots. We're not sure if any of them actually hit Kennedy. But there were five bystanders in the kitchen behind Kennedy and going back towards where, in the direction where Kennedy had come from the stage, who were hit in various positions. Paul Schrade was hit in the head and nobody was killed, but there were five bystanders injured. And there were also a number of suspected bullet holes in the center post of the connecting door between the backstage area and the pantry, and so on and so forth. So it seems that Sirhan fired wildly in the direction of Kennedy, but may have missed Kennedy and basically fired at a number of bystanders and done some damage to the actual room itself, whereas the actual Kennedy shots seem to have come from behind. So, you know, 180 degrees different direction from Sirhan, firing in either direction, and obviously much closer to him than Sirhan was, according to the witnesses.